This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. And I'm here with that chap called Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
Ho, ho, ho. I am absolutely phenomenal, Parv, as always. We're on this week again. We're on a... This should drop just before Christmas period, so Merry Christmas to all our listeners. The sack is brimming, the sack is full, the sack is ready to go. I just want to thank some listeners who sent questions in to lettersfromkayfabe@gmail.com. That's made the process a whole lot easier for us, so keep sending the letters in that way. Also use the hashtag lettersfromkayfabe if you were going to post them on Twitter. But sometimes it's easier to send them via email because it's a long form question, so it's easier to write instead of 140 characters. So yeah...
I love how old school we've gone, Alan. If you notice, I also included a P.O. box address that you can write to if you want to send a snail mail.
Oh, I caught that one on the synopsis for the last show. Maybe chuckle.
All right, well, let's hit the sack then. Come on.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Okay, first one in from the brimming sack today is Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite incarnation of Solo Fatu Jr. was always as Make a Difference Fatu. What are your thoughts on the character? Do you know of the angle with the Mystery Samoan Gangster Party and why that occurred? Do you think there was any other plans for Fatu? Cheers, guys. Really enjoying the show. And that's from Sam in South London. So, Fatu.
Who's Sam? I haven't heard of him before.
Well, there you go. Sam from South London, he sent a letter in to us. And yeah, so Fatu, he went from being a head shrinker to being Make a Difference Fatu. So you watched his original vignette, didn't you, Parv? What did you make of that?
Well, I actually thought it was phenomenal. He's down in the hood in South Central or wherever. I mean, I don't know the actual... But, you know, it's pretty rough, I think, to put it mildly. And he was, like, there with his boys. And... I thought it was really good. It kind of showed like some of like the graffiti in the streets and some of the kind of neighborhoods he was a part of. And then he showed the Cow Palace, which of course is a famous venue in San Francisco, which goes, you know, has roots right back with the original Samoans, you know, did that arena many times. And yeah, I thought it was phenomenal to make a difference thing. I mean, it's all about not forgetting your roots and showing where he came from.
Yeah, well, he hangs out in the hood next to the Cow Palace and explains that he grew up there, but he's bettered himself now through hard work, dedication, and staying away from drugs. So basically, his entire character was this guy who's trying to be basically a positive role model and a positive message for kids. So basically, he went from a barbaric, cannibalistic head shrinker to basically overnight to a guy who speaks perfect English and grew up in the US. So me at the time, I didn't really buy this, Parv, as a 13-year-old. It kind of looked a little bit suspect because he didn't cover up the fact that it was still Fatu. Didn't change his name or anything like that. They didn't change his hair colouring. I mean, obviously, they put him in different tights in this brightly coloured kind of jacket gimmick that was going on. But for all intents and purposes, you knew it was the same guy. So I don't know how anyone would buy into this character, Parv. Do you think that makes much of a difference? So do you think people would overlook that?
Well, it really depends on if they remember the head shrinkers or not. If it's the first time you're seeing the guy, it looks great. Yeah, it's problematic. I'll just say that. You know, I don't know where else to say. I guess it's a little bit business exposing. Would be the way I'd term it. You know, it's basically showing that he's been playing a character for all of these years and. The real man is this guy from the streets in California.
Yeah, and I think that was pretty much sums it up for me as well. I didn't buy into it at the time. So he actually made his the vignette aired in 95. It was in July 22nd, and then he shows up as one of the Lumberjacks in the Sid Diesel match at In Your House 2, and they had a Lumberjack match for the title. And then around that time, he was programmed on house shows against Rad Radford. I think he went on a small run with Rad Radford at first, and Henry Godwin. And he was beating jobbers on TV around this time to build himself up. And I think his first loss on TV was to the British Bulldog. That came a little bit later in the year. And yeah, we kind of just knocked around a bit in 95. He was a part of the Survivor Series eight man, one of the teams at the Survivor Series, the Dark Side, which was him, Henry Godwin, Savio Vega and The Undertaker, and maybe Hunthurst Helmsley, Isaac Yankem, Jerry Lawler and King Mabel. So he was around through 95 into 96. And in 96, it's quite interesting because we see a mysterious appearance of two guys at ringside, don't we, Parv? And there's one match you watched where these are shown. But you can talk to us about the actual match you watched and who was against and what you thought of the match.
Why didn't you remind me here, Alan? What's this?
It was the Steve Austin match you watched versus Fatu, I believe.
Yes. So this was right in the middle of the Ringmaster deal with, obviously, Austin with Ted DiBiase. And it's a pretty decent little match that goes on. And everything's kind of moving along, going back and forth. Eventually, there's a submission hold applied. And while he's still in this hold, two men appear at ringside, one of whom is, we established just before the show started, what was his name again, Alan?
One of them was Sammy the Silk, wasn't it? Who we know quite well, who's been in the WWF himself quite long periods of time.
Sammy the Silk, who apparently was Samu.
Which was Samu, yeah.
The original head shrinker. Of course, Samu had been gone because the head shrinkers, by the time Fatu turned into this version of Fatu, wasn't Samu and Fatu. It was Samu and
Sione.
Sione, yeah. Who was the Barbarian. So, I mean, long-term fans would instantly recognize him as the Barbarian too. So, you know.
More business exposing stuff there. So I don't think Vince really cares too much at the time. So, yeah, the first one of the mysterious guys who were later known in wrestling, the team changed, but it was the Samoan Gangsters, or the Samoan Gangster Party kind of went into an ECW. So it was Samu along with his cousin, Matt Inouye. And Matt Inouye is the son of Seeker. It became known as Big Matty Smalls. So those two were kind of skulking around at ringside. They were from Fatu's past. So obviously what they were attempting to do is have two guys that when Fatu was batting on the streets and taking drugs, yeah. You know, that they were his friends and now he's turned on them. So, they're coming for retribution. That was the whole idea. But it didn't actually happen on TV. It's kind of just faded away after this, the whole kind of idea. So that's basically about Make a Difference Fatu. He was always, I always remember him wearing a beanie hat. He liked to wear his beanie hats. He was very clappy to the fans and always glad handing the fans and things like that. But his run wasn't that long in this. So, I mean, Sam, you enjoyed him. He was your favourite incarnation. So you preferred this version of him than all the other versions that we've seen over the years of Fatu.
I mean, doesn't he become like the Sultan or something after this?
Yeah, he does the Sultan gimmick where he's teamed with, he's got Iron Sheik knocking with him and Bob Backlund. And he comes up at WrestleMania 13, he's on that show as well. You can't tell it's him then, to be fair. He shaves his head, puts in a kind of a ponytail and wears this muzzle kind of Hannibal Lecter mask over his face. So it was a change more so than the head shrinkers Fatu to the Make a Difference Fatu. Have you got any other memories of Fatu at all, or as he came later on as Rikishi?
Oh, tons. He was a wrestler for a long time, wasn't he? Samoan SWAT team, head shrinkers, two different versions. Obviously, Alan, I hated the Rikishi Fatu Too Cool stuff. I mean, I've always been a heel fan.
Yeah.
And you can imagine how much I loved what were they called? Too Cool?
Yes, Too Cool. Scotty Too Hottie and Grandmaster Sexay.
Yeah, I mean, when they used to just pause in the middle of matches and do those dances, I was just cringing. I hated that stuff. I really did. The Worm. Talk about business exposing. I mean,
I've seen Rikishi once live, and he started dancing at the end of a match. And I'll give you through one guess. Who do you think he would have been dancing with? It will annoy you.
Was it Too Cool?
No. It will annoy you for different reasons. He was dancing with Terry Funk.
Oh God! Why was Terry Funk lowering?
It was in Preston City Wrestling. So they brought Funk in. He did a Q&A. Me and some other guys started chanting "Forever, Forever" at him to kind of rekindle the stuff he did in Old Japan. In there, I think it was 82-83, doing that famous kind of promo after a match, which was a cool experience, and got to shake his hand and say a few words to him. But yeah, I seen him dancing in the ring with Rikishi and Vader. Mm. quite an eye-opening experience.
I will say I did quite enjoy his Hall of Fame thing. Not like Rikishi's Hall of Fame business. Not too long. Was that last year or the year before?
It was last year. It was recently, because he brought these two sons on there as well, didn't he? And they introduced him.
That all seemed pretty heartfelt to me. Like he clearly is a guy who loves the business. Whether he deserved to be in or not is a different question. But I mean, he had a decent career. Don't get me wrong, didn't he?
Like, no, he had a decent run. He was there for years. He was a dependable guy. He was pretty over in the, you know, in the Attitude Era. So he fits a place in the WWE Hall of Fame, I guess. Here's a question for you quickly. If you were a wrestler, Parv, would you prefer to be in the WWE Hall of Fame or the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame? What would be the one that you'd be most happiest to be in?
If I was a wrestler?
Yes.
Oh, without doubt, the WWE Hall of Fame. I mean, I'd get the ring, I'd get bookings, I'd get... recognition, I'd get put in video games. I mean, it's a massive payday. Probably.
But you won't get put over on Pro Wrestling Only and, you know, places like that. But,
I mean, get real. Any wrestler worth his salt cares more about that. I spoke to Ivan Koloff and it was clear he didn't give a shit about the Observer Hall of Fame, but it eats him up that he's not in the WWE Hall of Fame.
Well, it eats me up he's not in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Well, is he? Or did he get in the end? I can't remember.
I think he did get in, didn't he?
No, he did get in recently.
Yeah,
it was last year, wasn't it?
Last year he got in.
It ate me in before then, anyway.
But, I mean, he used to bug me that he wasn't in. But I think the Observer Hall of Fame is the sort of thing that me and you are going to get annoyed about. And the WWE Hall of Fame is the sort of thing that's going to matter if you're a wrestler. Because, you know, that is the benchmark in the business.
Well, that's ultimately saying that they're just craving Vince's approval, because it's ultimately his decision at the end of the day versus approval of 200 learned-ish people.
I think it might make a difference on what sort of wrestler you are. Like Chris Hero, who we spoke to a couple of weeks ago, I'd imagine maybe the Observer Hall of Fame would mean more to him, maybe. But, I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for him. But it seems like he might, somewhat a wrestler like that, of that generation, might care more about the Meltzer Hall of Fame, but I think the old timers are only going to care about Vince's one. So
no, I think that's fair. Obviously, you've spoken to Ivan.
But like, and not just that. I mean, I remember when like Harley Race went in. It clearly meant a hell of a lot to him to be recognised by the industry. You know, so
you think though it's someone strange, someone like Harley Race, that they're still seeking that approval after they've been, you know, in other Hall of Fames, like they've got the one in Waterloo, Iowa. I think it was in Iowa anyway. I don't know where.
I think it's because anybody who's anyone in the business is kind of sitting there, you know?
Yeah.
Like, even with Flair, it clearly means more to him than anything else. It doesn't really matter where you come from. That seems to be the thing that matters. So, I mean, if it, like, for me, which one means more? It's obviously going to be the Observer Hall of Fame. It's like we argue over it. The criteria is harder, but I mean, even that to me has been a little bit devalued in recent times as well, though, Alan.
Well, that's another topic for another day, I guess. Yeah, so I think we should move on to the next one. What do you reckon?
Yeah, let's move on. Sting. go on, Alan.
All right, so let's go back into the sack here before Parv loses it. Dear Alan and Parv, please tell me everything you can about my favourite obscure WWF personality, Rio Rogers. To my knowledge, he only made 3 appearances. He seemed to be aligned with Shawn Michaels. He hosted the showdown between Shawn and Razor Ramon and did a skit where he and Shawn visited the Hart home. I believe he also hosted Superstars at least once. How many appearances did he make? Also, why did Bruce Pritchard have so many short-lived gimmicks like the Wizard around this time? And that's thanks. And that's from Dwayne Jones in Bear Creek, North Carolina. So thanks for the question, Dwayne. And Bruce Pritchard, who's quite known at the moment, he's doing his own podcast with Conrad Thomas. It's quite a good podcast, actually, Parv.
Thompson.
Oh, Thomas, yeah, sorry. You've listened to that quite a few times yourself. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, it's not a bad show. I mean, I've kind of fallen off a cliff with it. not entirely because the fault of it. I've just various different things have meant that I've had to cut my podcast listening down. But it's kind of interesting that they bicker an awful lot on that show between them. And yeah, but I think Bruce Pritchard is quite refreshing in a way because he's so like on Vince's side on everything. And, you know, in our circles, that is in itself quite refreshing. Just to hear a guy who's so like dyed in the wool pro WWF or WWE on every single issue. You know, occasionally he'll give some decent insights. His show on Eddie Guerrero was really good, I thought.
Yeah, he does give you decent insights, and I think they play off each other quite well, him and the co-host. And I just think sometimes he completely discredits some of the reporters, Dave Meltzer, Wade Keller, people of that nature, too much. I mean, don't get me wrong, he was there. There's things he will know that maybe they've got wrong because they're getting it second or third hand. But on other occasions, their reporting is quite spot on, and he discounts it just because of all the reasons where they have been slightly off. But we're talking an industry that's very hard to report on. It's not like as open as something like anything else in sports or entertainment. It's very closed and guarded. So there's only so much wrestlers will tell to Dave and Wade and people like that, or people in the front office. So to protect their own self, and, you know, at the end of the day, he does his best job. So I think from that point of view, I think Bruce is a little bit unfair on him. But just getting back to the actual question, though. So Rio Rogers, a very short-lived gimmick. So this is definitely at the edge of the cheese platter, isn't it, Parv?
Yeah. I mean, it's basically Bruce Pritchard doing a Dusty Rhodes impression. I mean, that's about it, isn't it? He's basically just like a Dusty Rhodes knockoff Southern boy who knocks about with Shawn Michaels.
Yeah, he's completely got the accent or the kind of cadence in the way that he speaks. He doesn't look like Dusty. He's dressed a bit like some sort of weird cowboy, I would say, Parvo. He's got a hat on or a flat hat. Has he got a moustache at the time here?
Yeah, moustache, cowboy kind of. More towards like a Dutch Mantel.
Yeah, I think that was what I was thinking as well.
But with the voice and personality of Dusty. What the deal was with Sean, I mean, Sean's clearly a heel around this time. Wasn't he feeding with Razor Ramon?
Yeah, I mean, this is Sean at the time. He was just coming back from suspension. If you remember, he kind of had a bit of a falling out backstage. Left spat his dummy, so this was the start of that kind of era of Sean. So the title was held up, and then it was put up on an IC title battle royal that ended up being a match between Rick Martel and Razor Ramon. And then Shawn Michaels does come back, makes up with Vince and WWF, comes back. They do an angle where he still didn't lose the belt, so they had two titles, which then ended up being the kind of blow off was WrestleMania 10 with the infamous ladder match. But around this time, we did see Shawn Michaels with Rio Rogers. I think Rio Rogers did make three appearances that I can see. He made his debut, which we do catch, don't we, Parv? He does a guest commentary. I think it was for Superstars, and he's alongside Vince, replacing Jerry Lawler at the time, who'd disappeared off TV. I think this may have been the time when Lawler got into a bit of bother himself.
Sounds about right. So, yep, he appears on commentary. Yes. And then the second time, is it when they visit the Hart family home? Is that the second time?
Oh, no, I think there's another time, actually. It's just before Lawler doesn't disappear yet. He's not got fully into trouble here. He's not been hiding in the bushes yet, maybe. Lawler conducted an untelevised interview with Rio Rogers at a Superstars taping, which was on November the 10th, 93. And then we see the Shawn Michaels, Rio's roundup, which Michaels says he answers to no man in reference to his suspension with Razor Ramon, about Razor Ramon's suspension, Razor having the title. And Razor was an imposter, and he was a true intercontinental champion. And then Razor appeared and said if it was up to him, he would have beaten Michaels personally to win the title. Then Razor Ramon burst Michaels bubblegum with his toothpick. So the whole gimmick was obviously a knock on Dusty, wasn't it? WWF at the time, business was in the toilet. And I feel in a way Vince was, you know, like others as well, cheap digs. He's done this before with Dusty. I don't know what Dusty may have done at the time to irk Vince, but it was definitely a cheap dig at Dusty, wasn't it? And I don't see why Vince continued to do stuff on screen to get his enjoyment with as a character that's not got any legs to it. Is Rio Rogers going to go anywhere, really? You know, can you see that? Or what was the point?
To me, it's possible that it may even, this may be even one of those cases where Bruce Pritchard persuaded Vince that this was a good idea for whatever reason. Because I get the impression that Pritchard has got a bit of a nasty streak when at certain times, like on that podcast, he swears blind that the Polka Dots deal wasn't a knock on Dusty and that they weren't trying to, like, you know, one of the catchphrases on that show is, was it a rib? It wasn't a rib type thing.
Yeah.
My impression is that every so often he likes to twist the knife, and that actually comes through on the show itself. Like, you can just see that that's what he's like. And for some reason, I get the impression that it was Pritchard himself who wanted to get one over on Dusty for whatever reason. And Vince kind of just went along with it.
Well, that just could be rumours and innuendo, Parv, as they like to say on their show.
I've completely made that up. But just thinking about what was going on in 93, the sorts of stuff that Vince had on his mind, this seems like a deal where it could have just been a bit of free licence from Pritchard here. And then you've got to ask, well, why was it so short-lived? Somebody had to pull the plug.
It didn't work. They probably noticed this, and that was the end of that. Yeah. But during one time, around this time, I don't know what show it was, but do you remember the time WWF did Don't Fall for Cheap Imitations type vignettes that they used to run, because it was, you know, they were knocking the competition. Vince said on TV, we don't believe in cheap imitations except for Rio Rogers. So I'm not sure, I can't see that as footage. So take that with a pinch of salt, but apparently that was said. But also, apart from Rio Rogers, the question that was asked by Dwayne was about the Wizard. Sorry, Ron.
Just before we go on to that, now that Hart family home deal, that is really weird. Like, who is in the house? Is it like a guy in a mask? That was really strange. It reminded me of, like, I don't know, it was like a weird, like, art house video. Like, who, was that meant to be Stu in the house?
maybe it was. I mean, listeners can check it out. They can watch it on the playlist that will be out with the show this week. It'll be in the synopsis. So make your own minds up there. I wasn't too sure what they were trying to do there. I think it was all hastily put together at the last minute, as this gimmick looked like it was as well.
Very strange business. Okay, so the other part of the question was about the Wizard, who, as far as I can tell, was just Bruce Pritchard on commentary once. Is that right?
Yeah, the Wizard was basically Pritchard doing heel commentary with Gorilla Monsoon and All-American. I think he did it for a few weeks in 93. And it would call Pritchard instead of Pritchard the Wizard. And the Wizard character itself, like you said, Parv, was never seen on TV. And what actually Bruce Pritchard said about it, because he did a deal on Reddit, you know, those Ask Me Anything things, and he said the Wizard was just a good name I used instead of using my name, because I was in the studio. It was just a way not to use my name, that's all. I think Monsoon came up with the idea and the name. So there you go. So yeah. I don't know, at this time they were stuck on commentators, so they had to bring him back, because, as you know, Parv, on a lot of the house shows that made tape, you see Bruce Pritchard doing commentary now, 87 time, don't you?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to think of when this was. It would have been Mr. Perfect, who'd have been the main heel commentator on a lot of that stuff. But I guess he was back in the ring.
But Perfect was in the ring. He was a face then, because Perfect came back at SummerSlam 92, and he was still wrestling SummerSlam 93. Sorry, so it's Survivor Series 92, and then he came up to SummerSlam 93. I think he was still knocking around after that, but not too long. So I don't think it was him. Maybe we'd have to just check that one, who that was. Parv, who else there was up there? Obviously, there's Gorilla Monsoon. I don't think we had Stan Lane by this point yet, or anything like that.
He was just on his way out in that, it was May 93. He would have.
This was a bit later. This was like November time 93. So Heenan was on his way out. And also, if you remember, you had Joe Fowler.
He wasn't.
Who we discussed, and he was around about this that time as well. So I don't know if this may be. Well, Joe Fowler was on screen as a kind of interviewer, wasn't he? More the play by play.
More of a Sean Mooney.
Yeah.
And I guess DiBiase was about to come back. They are actually pretty thin on the ground, thinking about it.
Well, because I think it was maybe because of Heenan, because Heenan used to do All American with Monsoon, so maybe it was to plug the gap before they brought someone else in. So obviously they have Pritchard's always there, he's always in the studio, he's always around, so they may as well use him because he's got experience doing it.
I mean, he doesn't put on a silly voice or anything. It's not like him doing a Grand Wizard impression or anything like that. He's literally just Bruce Pritchard. but they call him the Wizard. So, yep. Final question.
Final question of this segment, then. So let's go one more time into the sack. It's hi, Alan and Parv. Hi. One of the most memorable angles of the first year of Monday Night Raw was the introduction of the 1-2-3 Kid. Can you give us some of the backstory about how he arrived in the company and ended up with the name? And that's thanks, Martin in Fife, Scotland. So, Martin, thank you very much for the question, and hi to you. So, he came in 1993, Sean Waltman, who had a bit of... he was known quite a lot on the indie scene before then because he'd wrestled in Global. He was known by the newsletters. He'd wrestled these, you know, really good matches against Jerry Lynn and people like that. So he was a complete change to what the WWF would use on TV in a pushed role, wasn't he, Parv? For me, because I was watching around this time, I thought, wow, you know, he was different. I didn't treat him too seriously. I don't know if that was what they wanted or not, but he was very small, he was very skinny compared to what we've seen on TV years previous, wasn't he?
Yeah, very, very skinny. Much smaller than even a jobber. He was just completely different build, completely different style of wrestler. And yeah, I mean, he'd been the Lightning Kid all over the indies. He's actually got some good stuff worth seeking out in the early 90s before this run, as you mentioned. But then he comes in 93.
Yes, it comes in April 93. So he has a few different names as well at first before they settle on the 1-2-3 Kid name. So it was the Kamikaze Kid when he jobbed to Doink on Raw and his kind of first on-screen appearance. And then he jobbed on next episode of Raw to Mr. Hughes. He was the Cannonball Kid. Yeah. And then this is where it gets interesting. So he's the next one is called The Kid on TV. But he actually started just before then. He started as the Lightning Kid, and he had a tryout match in Phoenix the day after WrestleMania 9. I don't know if you knew that. And he was against Louis Spicoli, who was later then going to be used on TV a couple of years later with Rad Radford. And he reminisced on the Steve Austin podcast that he was lucky to have an opponent with a vested interest in getting a good match, the same as him, rather than put with someone typically like a disinterested veteran like a Virgil. Hi, Virgil. There's his mention this week. Or Jim Powers or somebody like that who was knocking around this time. So he must have obviously impressed because he was, you know, used on TV only a month or two later.
Yeah. And then, well, basically he has this match with Razor Ramon on Raw. And, well, it's a very interesting match, isn't it? Because Raw is just, Ramon is just like beating the crap out of him, as you'd expect. And then he hits a flashy move from the top, catching Ramon by surprise. I think it was like a flying crossbody, something like that, and manages to get the upset victory.
It was totally out of the blue, wasn't it?
Pins him, and don't forget, he'd come in without any wins. He'd been defeated by Doink, he'd been defeated by Mr. Hughes. So he seemed like just a young jobber, you know? So the fact that this upset win came out of nowhere was a massive deal at the time. I mean, I remember this really well. And the crowd started chanting 1-2-3. And wherever Razor Ramon went, the crowd chanted 1-2-3. And that is how the 1-2-3 Kid name started to be used.
Yeah, I think that was pretty much it. And it was, like I said, a turn up for the books doing an angle like this. And I think it was a very clever way to turn Razor face, don't you think, Parv?
Yeah, so basically what happens now is that Razor Ramon, after like fed up of the crowd just really getting on his case, basically issues a $10,000 challenge.
Yeah, before that it was $5,000 and the kid didn't agree to it.
The kid wouldn't take the $5,000, but he made it $10,000, which in 1993 was like a life-changing amount. And Razor's got this wonderful line, he can buy himself a life, which I thought was pretty funny. And, I mean, I forgot how cool Razor Ramon was in 1993. Like, his music and, like, some of his heel promos were pretty good around this time. And basically, eventually, the kid accepts. And they have another rematch on Raw about a month later. And Razor really does kick the crap out of him in this one. And this was the match, Alan, where Vince was just saying, what a maneuver, over and over again. Because of the amount of like back suplexes and Samoan drops that we saw out of Ramon. And basically
He kills him during this match, and there's that one spot that is horrible where he slips off the top rope to the outside, 1-2-3 kid, and I think he legitimately knocks himself out at that point because he lands hard because there was no mats. They moved the mats during the match, and he just landed on the concrete face first, and it was nasty.
It's actually a really brutal 5-minute match. But basically the payoff is that the kid basically finds the sack of money, the $10,000, and runs off with it.
But it got into a waiting car. I thought it was really well done, wasn't it? Because it was in a Manhattan Center, which is a smaller building just next to the Hammerstein Ballroom. And obviously, it's just straight onto the streets of New York. It looks different. It looks cool. That's one time where it worked, doing something like this in that environment versus a big arena. You know, he could just quickly run out. He's straight through the back door. There's an awaiting car, and he speeds off, and there's Razor kind of shaking his fist at him, you know, as the kid speeds off. It was quite a good visual. So I enjoyed this part. I think it was something that will always stand out to me in my fandom, this kind of angle, and it really, really helped Razor Ramon, didn't it? So what actually happened after this was 1-2-3 Kid was then kind of used. So what we saw, he was working house shows then, Parv, where he was beating Terry Taylor, but also on TV. He got a win again. It was against Blake Beverly in June 5th, 1993. So he beats Blake Beverly, and it's quite an interesting match, this one, because I watched this one, because Blake starts the match with a slap, and then the kid gets fired up, which shows, you know, you like that in a, you know, a young upstart wrestler. Someone like Brian Pillman, I used to like it when he did kind of got fired up as well. But what Savage said was quite funny. Matt McMahon, Savage said he's got a lot of spunk, and I like that. And McMahon responded with, a lot of spunk, that's what it's all about. As we would later find out in porno movies as well, 1-2-3 Kid does have quite a bit of spunk. I had to bring it. I had to bring it that low, but there we go. But yeah, it's quite interesting because Blake's kind of not arsed in this match. You can tell because he's on his way out. He's not shaved his chest, you know, normally, like most of the wrestlers at the time. So he doesn't really give a shit. He's pretty much done with the WWF. So he kind of slaps the kid around and keeps going 1-2-3, 1-2-3 Kid, huh? And then he slaps and knocks him around a bit more. And Savage wonders, rightly so, why the referee isn't basically counting them out. So Blake Beverly looks good at this point as well. He does a really good jumping headbutt from a standing position. Then he throws Kid over the top rope to the floor, and Heenan says he knocked his eyebrows right off him randomly, which later on we know, I don't know if you know this, Parv, that there was a rib. The 1-2-3 Kid's first or second figure, you remember the figures that they used to have? They used to have an actual picture of the wrestler.
Yeah.
And a rib before the actual shoot to take the pictures, they shaved his eyebrows off.
Right, okay.
You're the best. So I'll actually send you this photo because it's fairly available online. If you just look 1-2-3 Kid no eyebrows or something on Google Images, you'll see it, and it's obvious on the actual wrapping of the little doll that he's got no eyebrows. So I thought that was quite funny. So those two are linked. I don't know about that eyebrow comment and that one, because I don't think they were making his figures that early on.
I'm looking at that now. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so you notice it, you do see it. So in the end, 1-2-3 Kid beats Blake Beverly in that match in 8 minutes. And then after that, on Challenge, Parv, did you watch this match against Ted DiBiase?
Yes, I did indeed. I also remember it very well.
Was this Ted DiBiase's last great match?
Well, I mean, as per usual, Ted puts in a great performance, beats the crap out of the kid, wonderful scoop power slam, and then Razor basically comes to ringside watching Ted totally decimate the kid in this match, and DiBiase's so arrogant he tries to cover him just by kind of laying on him with his back, and that allows the kid to get in a sneaky pin, like a backslide pin thing, which gives him the upset defeat. Ted chases him away and then gets into it with Razor, who's literally over the moon and laughing at his misfortune. Now, here's the thing I didn't get about this, and I've never quite understood it. Is this Razor's heel turn right here?
Face turn.
Is this his face turn right here? As in, was Razor a heel when he came to ringside? Like, did anything else happen between Razor and the kid for them to reconcile between these two points, or is this the turn?
This is pretty much the turn from memory, because after this, obviously, it cost him. He was cheering, so DiBiase being, you know, maybe a more dastardly heel than Razor, because he's been around for years, getting his comeuppance. Thanks to Razor Ramon, that was basically it. I don't think they did any more than that, because straight away after that, we saw Razor working against heels. And then he went on to win the IC title just 2 or 3 months after this as well, if you remember.
So here's the one thing that I've never really understood about how all of this was paid off. Because I agree, it's a phenomenal way to make 1-2-3 Kid. It's a great angle, in my view. One of the great kind of debut angles of all time, I guess. So basically, this ends up being a great build to DiBiase versus Razor at SummerSlam, which is DiBiase's last match, as we know, for the WWF, which is a great way to make Razor as the babyface, you know, going over a really established big-time heel. What I don't understand is 1-2-3 Kid ends up facing IRS, who takes his head off with, you know, the brilliant write-off check that I mentioned last week.
Yeah.
But that's basically it. He gets killed by IRS in the pay-per-view match, so that's the only bit of it I don't understand. Like, what's the point of building him up only to get completely destroyed by IRS?
No, I don't know why that, because obviously they needed to do something with IRS, though, because I think at this point Ted had given his notice.
Right.
And obviously IRS isn't going anywhere near All Japan in 1993. I think that was the reason. So they needed to do something else with IRS. 1-2-3 Kid. I mean, at the end of the day, he's going to have to lose some and win some. And IRS, you can believe they would lose to someone like IRS, former tag team champion. And, you know, he was knocking around in matches versus Hogan at WrestleMania, you know, just a few months removed. So I think it wasn't as bad as you think. But yeah, it was pretty much Razor Ramon after this. He went on and against Jerry Lawler, and then he went on TV and he was beating the jobbers as a face, Dwayne Gill and people like that.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I am a fan of that whole deal, though, in general. And now that you've said it, they did need to rebuild IRS as a singles guy. So it makes sense.
Let's take you down to the event center.
Thank you, Parf. Thank you, Alan. JT Rosero here inside the Letters from Kayfabe Event Center. Want to wish you all out there a very Merry Christmas coming up this weekend. And of course, wrestling and Christmas go hand in hand, just like most holidays do. Looking back to World Class Championship Wrestling, Christmas Star Wars, some of their biggest shows, as well as always once WCW made the switch from Thanksgiving to December, always Starcade had that Christmas feel, and WWE always throws out Christmas themed shows as well, whether it's a pay-per-view or a TV show. But my biggest wrestling Christmas memories come, of course, from opening presents from Santa as a kid, and what wrestling-themed gifts would we receive? There was a Hulk Hogan wrestling buddy that still sits right next to me here in my studio. And, of course, it was 1 year in 1992 I received a bunch of Hasbro action figures that I didn't even know were released. It was a surprise. Jim the Anvil Neidhart, the Mountie, the Warlord. And footage may exist of me receiving these figures and just melting down, not knowing that these pristine additions to my collection were coming. So I hope all of you out there have the same memories when it comes to wrestling and Christmas as I do. And even, you know, into the late 90s when I received the WrestleMania VHS box set from my parents as a Christmas gift. So it goes out there many, many years. The Raw's War video game and different other games that would come out from wrestling and videos and tapes and gifts. And, of course, that's what Christmas is all about, right? It's a reason for the season. So back to you, Parv and Alan. Hope you have a great holiday yourselves over there across the pond. We'll be back next week with another great episode. Be sure to check out everything going on at PlayStation.com. And, of course, come back each and every day. All of our feeds, follow us on iTunes. And until next week, I'll talk to you later. This is JT Rosero. Take care.
All right. And now, Alan, I think it's time for our long topic.
It is. And different one this time, which I think we're going to enjoy answering. So long topic is, dear Alan and Parv, I've asked you guys about a lot of my favourite memories, but what are your favourite memories from the time period of 1984 onwards? And that's from our old buddy Chadley Crisolo in Newark, Connecticut. So thank you, Chadley. You've not told us who your favourite wrestler is. You've left it open-ended, so whoever it was last time, that's your favourite wrestler, and we're going to move on from that. So Parv, some favourite memories. Let's go on this one, because I think we can have a little bit of fun here.
Yeah, well, I've been really thinking about this since I saw the question. Alan. And I mean, I kind of we've mentioned quite a few of my favourite ones already on the show, but one of the ones that will always stick with me is that I used to watch a lot of wrestling over the road. I've told you this before. There was an old woman who lived across the road who was friends with my mother called Phyllis, okay? And for whatever reason, she was really into WWF, which I think is one of those things that isn't talked about enough, Alan. It's the old woman wrestling fan, which has always been a thing, both in America and in Britain. Did you know any kind of older women who like the wrestling?
Yeah, I did. Mine was a summer story. There was my nan at the time worked in kind of a convenience shop in a village where she lives, and the owners of the shop, it was an elderly couple, and the guy, he was obsessed with TV, to the point where he got a big satellite dish in his back garden, and he was able to use it and control it to point it at different satellites to get, you know, different feeds of things. So he was always on TV, and they used to enjoy the wrestling, but they never got it, the American feeds of it. I always got the Sky ones, but they used to tape it for me. They used to get 4-hour long play tapes from the shop that they actually owned, put it as long play, so it was 8 hours, and they used to tape 8-hour blocks for me of wrestling at a time. So in like 1995, this would have been, I was getting all the kind of Jeff Jarrett doing the kind of singing gimmick when he was trying to, you know, be the singer with that song that he had, With My Baby Tonight. So I kind of, that all stands out to me around that time. So yeah, it was definitely, there's definitely older people that like the Graps as well as us young folks.
Well, anyway, I was over there 1 week, and I can't even remember exactly when this was. It was sometime in the early 90s, and I was there, and a match came on. It was my favourite, of course, Ted DiBiase, taking on Bret Hart, okay? Now, I want to say that this was maybe the rerun of the 1989 match they had in Odessa, Texas, but I can't be sure. It could be one of the others. You know, it's kind of memory's hazy when you're a kid.
Yeah.
But anyway, this match came on, and it was like, in my mind at that time, one of the greatest things I'd ever seen. It was just like, wow, these are two great wrestlers, they're going at it. And I looked around, and Phyllis was into it, and everything seemed absolutely right in the world in that moment. I don't know, it was just one of those things that's always stuck with me. Like, and, you know, looking back now, you might be like, oh, yeah, well, it's only really a 3-star match or whatever. But for me at that time, as a kid then, it felt special. So that's one of the things that I can get right back to that moment. I can even remember, like, the slightly sagging flour that she had on the side and a cup of tea and a little cake there. It was, yeah, it made me very,
life was good.
It made me very happy in that moment. Well, what about you?
Well, the one that stands out for me, favourite moment, was it was April the 13th, 94. So this is when the match was, it aired on tape delay in America. So it would probably been the start of May for me, 94. And this was when Diesel beat Razor Ramon for the IC title, and it aired on Superstars. So for me, I remember that match vividly because I was so shocked that you saw a title change on Superstars, because bear in mind, Superstars didn't really have title changes around this time in 94. I mean, Superstars of Wrestling, before this, there was two IC title changes in 1990 between Perfect and Kerry Von Erich. But before that, pretty much the titles really changed hands on pay-per-views and things like that. So to see that, it was a shock. I really loved Diesel for some reason at the time. Big kick-ass guy, you know, he did loads of kind of crazy things at Royal Rumble 94, threw a load of people out, kicked the shit out of Virgil. So yeah, it was someone that I was pro Diesel. So when he beat Razor Ramon for the title, totally unexpected, I rushed out into the front garden and just started leaping with joy, shouting yes, yes, yes. I'm sure some people saw me at the time, and I got a little bit embarrassed and went back inside. But in that moment, I was so happy that I saw a title change unexpectedly, and it was Diesel beating Razor Ramon for the title. So that was a really standout memory for me growing up.
Yeah, another one of mine, Alan, would be, I mean, I don't know how to put this, but basically all of SummerSlam 92. It was a big deal. I knew people who were going. Obviously, I didn't go myself. In fact, I got a friend, a guy called Matt, who went to SummerSlam. And, you know, like they did those things on the Coliseum tape of like the fans outside and everything.
Oh my God, please tell me your fan Matt had a bowl head and he was that fan with that line.
No, unfortunately not. But there's a moment where they go down the queue outside of Wembley, and at the very moment that the camera went past, my friend Matt did up his shoelace. So his mother is there, his brother is there, and he is missing because he's doing up his that's always been something that I like to bring up every once in a while. He's basically not on the Coliseum tape because he was doing up his laces. But basically, of all the things that happened on that show, I was a real mark for whose corner is Mr. Perfect going to be in as a storyline. There was something about that whole storyline that really grabbed me. And I remember the first time I sat down and watched SummerSlam 92, I marked so hard for the kind of skullduggery that Flair and Perfect, when it turned out that they're in neither of their ring, they're in neither corner, and when they beat the holy hell out of Savage, they that brutal attack on his leg, I just absolutely loved that. And I've probably seen SummerSlam 92 100 times, not 100 times, but dozens of times, well enough to kind of know bits off by heart and things like that. And yeah, I just love the way that whole thing is played. Just seemed awesome to me. I could pretty much pick any event from 92, but I think maybe that moment of that one. So
yeah, it was a special moment, especially in the UK. There was a big kind of hoo-ha about the event. The Sun and the Mirror newspapers around this time are running kind of loads of competitions to kind of win tickets and pull out posters inside the newspapers. And these are national newspapers that have circulations of millions. And they're kind of putting over the WWF as this big thing. And it was huge. And so many podcasts that I've been involved with and you've been involved with, we discussed this at length elsewhere. But it was a massive deal over. This was peak WWF in the 90s, was, SummerSlam 92, I would say, when capped off with Bulldog beating Bret Hart for the title.
Absolutely.
Title, sorry.
Yeah, 92 is the absolute peak of wrestling in this country, in my mind, in terms of WWF being a massive thing that kids talk about. I guess in my fandom, there may have been, I wasn't a kid in 1998 or 1999, so I don't know what it was like in school, I guess. But for me, that seemed like it was big.
It was a fantastic event. I know a long-time listener of this show, Ren, shout out to Ren. I know he was at the show live and some other guys, and I've seen some photos. And, I mean, for me, did you ever go to the old Wembley Stadium, Parv, where SummerSlam was held?
Sadly, no. I've been to the new one, and I've been to the Millennium Stadium, but I never got to go to the old Wembley.
Well, you need to support a good football side like Blackpool, who many a time got there in playoff finals, you see, Parv. So the problem with the old Wembley that I felt was you were hell of a way from the pitch. So with the actual wrestling ring being in the centre and video screens not being what they are today, it wasn't really great lines of sight. And you obviously at the old Wembley as well, you had the pillars, going all around the stands. So it wasn't perfect by any means, and from photos I've seen that, but at the time I was jealous of as hell to anyone that was going. I didn't know anyone personally, but just in general, knowing that a WWF mega event like SummerSlam was going to be 3 hours, 4 hours drive from my house, it was quite upsetting that I'd ever made it there.
Now, just before I move off the topic of SummerSlam 92, I know it's something that we maybe talked about briefly years ago. But I've always felt that that American fans feel like they give Bulldog a bit too much credit for drawing that gate. Like, he was a big star, but I want to say that it would have drawn no matter what. That's where I feel. I feel like Bret was a huge star. I feel like Savage and Warrior, these were the sorts of toys that the kids had in school. Like, Bulldog was big, but he was big because he was a babyface in the WF, not necessarily because he was British. That's just my take on things. Got any views?
I think, excuse me, you're right to a point. I think Bulldog took it over the edge. He was like the cherry on top, right, to have a kind of homegrown star. I mean, he would have made it anyway. It would have tasted good, like an ice cream would without the cherry on top. But that just kind of completed it, that the final match on that show was a British guy being brought to the ring with Lennox Lewis, if you remember, flying the flag for him. It was a big deal at the time, and I think it really kind of helped cement the legacy that WWF has to this day, you know, how popular they went on to be. And I think it all came from kind of the push of the Bulldog, and there was that affinity there from us. Yeah, it would have drawn anyway, but I think, you know, we had no Hogan on the card, so you know, true. I think, to be fair, I think having Bulldog on there did help. But I think, and maybe they would have sold out 80,000, we're never going to know. It would have been a huge show anyway, but I think that, like I said, the Bulldog was that cherry on top.
Sure. Okay. And I mean, it was lovely that it happened, but I don't know. My like, when I think of who was really over when I was a kid, Legion of Doom were loved by kids. I mean, even though wrestling fans will think, oh, you know, they're not as good as they were when they were the Road Warriors. In 1992 in Britain, it seemed like Legion of Doom were amazing. Warrior, Brett was loved. People did like Bulldog. I mean, who else did kids really like?
Savage, I think.
And Savage also, yeah.
So I think they were the main guys, and obviously I did support players.
A few like Sid fans, maybe. Like, some people thought Sid was cool, I guess.
Yeah.
But those were mainly the ones. I would like, in terms of like who had pencil cases and folders, and, you know.
Duggan. Don't forget Duggan.
Duggan, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Can't forget him. I've got some few here, Parv, quick memories that stand out for me. Do you remember WrestleMania 9? There was a match that was postponed on the show, and it was actually admitted on the show that it was postponed. And that was a match between Kamala and Bam Bam Bigelow.
Right, yeah.
And do you remember the reason why that they gave why the match was postponed?
No, why was that?
It was because Kamala was found frolicking with the animals backstage. Because obviously the whole thing was WrestleMania 9 was at Caesar's Palace, and they brought some elephants and all the kind of animals there for whatever reason, because it was kind of Caesar's gimmick, and I don't know, did he have elephants at the time, Caesar? That's kind of what they were pushing, and Cleopatra, I guess, and the whole kind of Egyptian and Roman thing. So yeah, they had Kamala was frolicking with the animals, which made me laugh. So that was one thing. And there's another thing where in 93 as well was Duggan. There was a thing going at King of Ring 93 that Duggan had broken his ribs, okay? Mm-hmm. Or he'd injured his ribs. And I remember, and I don't know why, and I don't know what the reasons were, but there was a line from Heenan when he basically said Duggan hadn't broken his ribs. He was choking on American apple pie. And for me at the time, I don't know why, that just stood out for me. It's a ludicrous reason why you couldn't have a wrestling match. You were choking on American apple pie. But yeah, I think the other one as well that's famous for me around this time was Gene Okerlund at Royal Rumble 92. When he's interviewing, it could have been Flair after Flair won the Royal Rumble, and the whole put this cigarette out at the mock press conference. So what I thought at the time, there was a guy just casually having a Marlboro Red in the corner watching Ric Flair cut an awesome promo about going 60 minutes and winning the Royal Rumble. And me and Gene just stopped listening to Flair and just told this guy, damn it, mate, put that cigarette out. As a kid, and even now to this day, I love that line. And I do, when I want to cheer myself up, I will put that on, because it is on YouTube, it's just that line. And quickly as well, some other bits that kind of stand out for me was all the guys that came in, Parv, in 95, 96 from WCW. So you had your Foley's, Austin, Vader, Dustin Rhodes' Goldust came in a few months before that. And I thought that was a real change and real shift, because they didn't really bring in many WCW guys before that. And they brought a slew of them in all at once. And they were good workers as well. All of them. Pillman as well, Mark Merrow.
Merrow, yeah.
And these all guys were good workers, weren't they? None of them were bad.
No, they were all good.
Good to great, really. I mean, Dustin Rhodes was kind of ruined a bit under the Goldust character for you know, a few years there. You know, Foley was awesome as Mankind. Steve Austin found his footing. You know, like I said, Vader was hurt a little bit due to the fact that it was the Shawn Michaels era, and he was never going to let Vader get over to the extent that he did in WCW and be that killer heel. So it wasn't really going to work as well because of that reason. But I think they're all good names, and they're all guys that could put on good matches. And I think that stands out to me as a great memory at the time, all these guys coming in, especially Pillman. He was a sentimental favorite. He always will be of mine. So after knowing that Pillman went through the automobile accident just beforehand, he still got signed by WWF. He was brought up on TV. He was kind of around a little bit, not wrestling, for a few months. and all that kind of thing. And then the gun angle that went with Pillman and Austin that was pushing the envelope in 96 that Bruce Pritchard covered at length at one of his podcasts, actually. It was quite interesting. So they're all good memories for me. And the last one I'm going to mention is the whole Goldust Roddy Piper WrestleMania 12 backlot brawl, Parv.
Right, okay.
I loved Roddy Piper taking the bump of getting run over, taking the Jerry Lawler bump, you know, like Jerry Lawler did with Eddie Gilbert in 1990 in the WMC studios in Memphis. So we have the Piper bump, and then they cut to footage of OJ, which I'm going to admit at the time, I had no clue that was OJ footage.
Right, okay.
You know, at the time, it wasn't covered as it was. You know, you'll have people like your Chris Zellners and people will say it was massive news, worldwide news. To me, as a 96, I would have been 14-year-old. I'd heard about the OJ stuff. I remember Inside Wrestling kind of did a mock OJ trial, but had wrestlers instead of them. So Ron Simmons was playing OJ Simpson, for instance, randomly. I do remember that, but it was never anything that was really memorable to me. It wasn't covered in my world anyway. So seeing that, and I actually thought that was real. You know, I marked out, I caught that one, you know, hook, line and sinker. But that was kind of a good memory for me, seeing Piper, because he was always a favourite of mine.
I have to say, probably I was a bit sadder than you, Alan. I watched a lot of OJ Simpson trial, and I got into like the members of his team. Like, everybody remembers Johnny Cochran, but I remember like Shapiro and some of like the other members of the defense team as well.
Where did you watch it then, Parv? Did you just cover it? Not, was it just on standard BBC?
I'm trying to remember what side it was on. It would have been on fairly late, like 11 p.m. or something. Like,
were you one of those weird children at 13 that was watching Question Time and Newsnight?
Oh yeah, I always did. I watched. Yeah, yeah, I did. I was, I guess, weird.
Doesn't surprise me, Parv. So what memories do you have then that stand out to you? Other ones?
Well, I mean, I've got quite a few from Saturday night's main event, which is something that we haven't really discussed much on this show. But we didn't really see a lot of those on TV. Well, I didn't as a kid. Didn't see a lot of Saturday night's main event. Maybe a little bit before when I was around as well. But years later, I'd say around 2000, 2001 sort of time, I bought all of Saturday Night's Main Event, get this, on VHS tapes, okay? And it came in like, if you can imagine, basically a sack, an actual sack. You know that kind of...
I've got one next to me just here, Paul.
Yeah, you know that kind of brown cardboardy material? And yeah. I was at university at the time. And I always remember my dad phoned me up and he was like, son, what is this? I was like, what? He was like, this sack has arrived and it's full of videos. What the flying fuck are you doing? I was like, oh, that'll be Saturday night's main event. He was like, yeah, it's wrestling. And I spent like a decent dollar on that as well. So when I got back, I basically sat down and watched like the entire, all of Saturday Night's Main Event in like a couple of weeks, just watching these videos back to back. And so I was seeing a lot of this stuff for the first time, you know, around 2000, 2001 in like the summer holidays. And Uncle Elmer's Wedding and Jesse Ventura shitting all over that is one of the most, like, I'd say in all the times I've been a wrestling fan, probably one of the times I've marked the hardest for anything. Just how brutal Jesse is on Uncle Elmer during that whole thing. So I can't. It's one of the early Saturday Night's main events, but definitely that. Also of note, the slide race that Jimmy Hart and Junkyard Dog have.
They
have.
Oh my God! I forgot about
they
that.
Have like a water slide race. I was like, what is this? Saturday Night's main event? Is a lot of fun. To be fair, it's really like well put together. You know.
Do you like the Halloween episode in 1985, Parv?
Yeah, that's a lot of fun as well. We will have to save some Saturday Night's main event because we need to go through some of this stuff in proper detail one day. Because there's so much good stuff in there. So yeah, that. I talked about IRS getting defeated for the IC belt. I was gutted about that. I remember vividly reading about title switches that happened in 1992 and 93 that just like happened. Like, especially like Money Inc. Steiner Brothers. Like, I'd just be reading, oh, they won the belt and then they lost the belt. And then that was probably in like PWI. You know, do you remember when they used to like print out all of those results, and you'd be going through it, and you'd be thinking, oh, this happened, but they didn't mention it, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
One of the things probably that stands out a lot is the summer of 93, the summer of Lex Luger and the Lex Express. Now, for some reason, I've always hated the baby faces. For some reason, I've kind of got aboard, like, I got aboard the Lex Express a little bit, like, in 93, I was kind of into it. And I remember just waiting forever for the SummerSlam 93 tape to come out. And I think it didn't actually hit the shelves until September. But the day I got SummerSlam, I remember I got my parents to take me to WH Smith's in the next town. I went in, I gave my £15 or whatever it was. And just the excitement of getting SummerSlam 93 home and watching it. You know, again, just one of those things. You can't really get that excitement back now, I don't think.
You definitely don't. And I mean, I remember at the time waiting for the videos. I loved the whole Lex Express thing as well at the time. I mean, we hip tossed, body slammed Yokozuna on the USS Intrepid. And I also liked at that time, they used a whole different host of people to try and slam him. So you had the Steiners tried it, maybe, Crush, Savage was the last one to try it. But you also had some kind of NFL stars, and you had a few basketball players there as well, if memory serves me right. And I always thought, why is this skinny, tall basketball player going to slam Yokozuna? That's not going to happen. And then Lex Express, Lex saves the day and comes in the chopper, doesn't he?
Yeah, and this is one of those things, Alan, like, I know people sometimes make fun of me for being a bit stuck in the past and all this sort of thing, but I do think that all of these things that we're talking about, it's like why we stay as fans, I think. Like, there's something about, like, wrestling that, like, something keeps you coming back, and there's something about it being like a kind of, I don't want to say safe place, but it's kind of like, sometimes you can watch wrestling and feel all right, do you know what I mean? It's like a weird thing, but like, no matter how serious you take it or not serious you take it, there's something about all of these memories that we're talking about that, I don't know, it's like its own little world, and it feels all right to be in that world sometimes. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it does, most of the time, until you hear these sleazy stories that come out from time to time and you want to have to go and wash yourself in the shower multiple times. But yeah, going back to the SummerSlam 93 kind of run was the Lex Express. I mean, the thing that really rounded it all off and made it all a perfect package was the song, the I'll Be Your Hero song, and the music video.
Yeah.
That they aired, you know, every week on TV, with Lex, like, flexing his muscles and some poor little disabled child coming up to him and trying to flex his muscles and, you know, all that sort of fun stuff. So there was, and, you know, Lex is there and he was posing with, you know, the presidents. I want to get shot by the American listeners.
The Mount Rushmore.
Yes, Mount Rushmore. And he's there at Mount Rushmore posing with the Ali Zubas on his red, white and blue Zubas and things. So, yeah, awesome time. So just before we kind of wrap up the show, Parv, have you got any last memories you want to mention?
I guess maybe, I mean, I've mentioned the that Bossman and Akeem promo that my brother watched over and over again. I think it's the WrestleMania 6 thing. That will always stand out for me. And also the little moment on that same show, Bossman and Akeem, former tag team partners. I'll always mention that one. But I think probably the latest one was that whole time period. I don't have a particular skit in mind, but the whole time period where Vince and Stone Cold Steve Austin and Kurt Angle were hanging out as a little heel trio. I don't think I've ever laughed as much as a wrestling fan than during that stuff. You know, that little, when they all get gifts for each other and Kurt.
Yeah, the summer of 2001. So we're just drifting slightly away from our kind of bit here. But, you know, it was definitely funny. I do remember that.
That is one other thing. I mean, it's a little bit outside of our normal time zone. And I very rarely talk about the Attitude Era, but that is one period that really I just thought, I mean, regardless of what you think of heel Austin and, you know, what a bad idea the term was, that has got to be some of the funniest stuff ever, hasn't it?
No, it was really funny. Kurt Angle really played, Austin played a great straight man to Kurt's kind of comedy man, and Kurt wearing the tiny little hat, you know, little cowboy hat to Austin's normal one and things like that. And Vince just being there as well, and Austin rolling his eyes at Vince and Kurt Angle. And yeah, it made for great, interesting kind of dynamic with Austin, because Austin also turned heel and aligned himself with McMahon at WrestleMania 17, which went down like a lead balloon. to some degree. But Austin played, it was quite interesting around this time. He was a heel, but he was also funny. But then he could be quite brutal, depending on what mood he was in. So he was a multifaceted character around this time. It was quite interesting. But that definitely was a good memory. And I mean, to be honest, I'm thinking of loads more as we're speaking now. But, you know, we try and keep the show at a certain length, don't we, Parv?
We do like to keep it to an hour. And unfortunately, WWF Magazine Corner suffers every week, doesn't it? Every week these days.
I know it does. We're going to have to be a little bit tighter on some of the answering and not going on rambles. But I think that's half of the fun of this show. We'll kind of flitter onto something else to remember. So I hope the listeners can not mind too much that we missed the Magazine Corner again.
So basically, Alan, we may have to go on a short break after this week, because as people are hearing this, I will be have moved into my new flat, and as things stand, BT being what they are, I won't have internet, and I'm not set to have internet for some weeks, and I'm very upset about it. But it does somewhat hamper my ability to record. So we may have to have a couple of weeks off while I get reconnected.
Yeah, I'm sure the listeners won't mind. So, yeah, like Parv said, it'll be a week or two. We'll keep you updated on Twitter, and I may post in some of the forums as well, just to give people an update there. Or you can tweet me and ask me what's going on. Is Parv alive? And I'll try and send a carrier pigeon to him and see if he can respond to me. That or smoke signals, Parv. That's what you're going to have to resort to now. You're not on the information superhighway, the World Wide Web. Back to more prehistoric ways of communication.
I mean, I will have my iPhone, I guess. So I do have I'll probably be able to send the odd tweet or the odd tweet or two, but you can't really record a podcast on your iPhone. So, all right, and if people do want to get in the meantime, what's the email address again?
Email address, as always, is lettersfromkayfabe@gmail.com. All the other way is if you tweet us or just put the hashtag lettersfromkayfabe in a message, we'll find it and we'll definitely add them to the sack for 2017. So we just want to thank everyone. We've had a great run so far, haven't we, Parv? We're now on to episode 16, and we're looking to do plenty more things in 2017. So I'm quite excited for the future. I don't know about you, Parv.
Absolutely. So join us then. For Letters from Kayfabe.
Adios.
Gee, oh yeah, now take it away, Vince McMahon, dig it, yeah.
Would you welcome, please, ladies and gentlemen, Razor Ramon.
Ah, Bobby Heenan, what do you think? What a kickoff that was when Razor Ramon went against the Hitman Bret Hart. What do you think?
That was a great match, but I'll tell you something. He was distracted. He's still thinking about the 1-2-3 kid. I want to know what's in that bag.
Oh, exactly. He was distracted, but what a match it was. Razor Ramon is a great competitor. I've always said that, yeah.
Well, Mr. Ramon, seems to me that you have become increasingly frustrated as of late with this young man, the 1-2-3 kid.
Isn't that rude? I like it.
It seems as though he's not going to get back in the ring with you for any amount of money.
Yo, kid. Oyeme, chico. I think I figure out the problem. Stickman, you don't have to try to beat me, man. Because everybody knows nobody can beat the bad guy.
That's not
now,
true.
Now, wait a minute. How has it felt? I know that a lot of the wrestlers, and certainly a lot of the fans, every place you've gone since the 1-2-3 kid unquestionably upset you. I mean, it seems as every place you must hear 1-2-3 in your dreams.
1-2-3!
1-2-3! It has to be so frustrating for you.
Okay, everybody listen to me. Stickman. Mira, chico, $10,000.
Wow.
And for you, man, with this kind of money, you could go out and buy a life. McMahon, with this kind of money, you could get that personality transplant you've been wanting.
Again.
Stickman, chico. I hear you talking about your family, tu familia. You want to help them. Help yourself. come down here, Chico. Step into the ring in front of all your fans, man. And let the bad guy prove it was a fluke.
But what happens if right here, what happens if he accepts the $10,000? You have the rematch and he beats you again. One, two, three. What
happens? Good question. I like it.
Okay, okay. Everybody laugh it up. Stickman, I know it, you know it, and as soon as you get in the ring, everybody gonna know it. Razor Ramon is the main man in the WWF, and no little punk like you gonna stop.
Thank you very much for joining us, Razor Ramon with a $10,000 offer.
Oh, yeah. $10,000. What could that punk kid do with 10 grand, Savage?
Razor Ramon sounds frustrated and desperate. Hey, listen, the 1-2-3 kid, if the ball's in his court, he's got a victory on his side, and he's famous overnight. 1-2-3 kid, yeah. How do you like that?
Yeah, pick a 10 grand just like that.
Well, yeah, you can, but maybe he doesn't have to. You know what I mean? What it is, what it is.
Punk.